Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collections, and I would like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. We're delighted that you're here. I just want to bring your attention to the flyers we have here off to the side of the table, which announce other events coming up in the library, specifically two more events for the Michigan Writers Series on April 4th, a memorable evening of the Student Writers Night, and on April 18th, Stuart Dybeck from Western Michigan University will be here to give a reading. But for tonight's reading, and I'm delighted to introduce to you Lizelle Litzenberger. Lizelle Litzenberger's essays and stories have appeared in numerous literary journals, magazines, and anthologies. She has written and reviewed for the Chicago Tribune and the Detroit Free Press. She has taught writing at several colleges and universities, including the University of Michigan, and a position as acting chair of the Creative Writing Program at the Interlochen Arts Academy. Her first collection of short stories, Now You Love Me, was published in 2001. She was a 2001 writer-in-residence at New College of the University of South Florida, and she is now assistant professor of English at Central Michigan University, teaching graduate and undergraduate creative writing. She is the recipient of a 2003 Michigan Council for the Arts and Cultural Affairs Creative Artist Grant for fiction writing and is at work now on a new novel. And also I'll bring your attention to Lizelle's new book, which will be for sale, if you wish, after the reading. So without further ado, Lizelle Litzenberger.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks so much for coming out to hear me read. I thought tonight that I would read, not from my collection, which came out about a year and a half ago, although I'd be really happy if you still wanted to buy a copy. Takes place in northern Michigan, and it's about a family told from the perspective of one of the daughters. I thought instead I would read from some new work, actually my novel in progress, which takes place in the same part of the world. Different characters, different time period, but some of the same sense of setting and place, and also not exactly the same characters, but they could live down the street, as I was telling Stephanie in an interview earlier. The novel's yet untitled, and I'm going to read several shorter sections. It's in vignettes at first, and it's based upon a guy who's had something very traumatic happen in his life, and we see him waking up, and then we see all the other characters who end up being important in the rest of the novel, what they're doing at exactly that moment. So I'm going to omit one section, and I'll sort of explain that when I get to that. Other than that, it should be, I hope, self-explanatory. So this is the first section, and it's called Grace Blackwater. The person's name actually begins the sentence of each section. Grace Blackwater is downstairs saving his life, one small gesture at a time. He can hear her straight through the worn wooden floor beneath his bed, going about her business as if she owns the place. This is on the first day of June, the very last day time will carry him forward. Of course, he does not yet know this. We are all blind in the face of dreams. He lies still and listens to Grace bang around in the kitchen below, cupping his ear to the pillow and drifting in the unfamiliar, beautiful sound of another person in his house. When Caroline had been there, his favorite thing in the world was falling asleep to the sound of her turning the pages of a book, her slow breathing, the clicking off of the lamp. He'd sail into that moment, not quite out, not quite awake, and she'd talk in her sleep, Caroline would, long sentences that meant nothing and everything. And later, when it was too late, he wished he had told her this just once. Caroline, your secrets are like poems. Caroline, I can hear you dreaming. But he had never said these things out loud. It is impossible to imagine that the sound of someone's voice can be lost forever until it is gone. He had never guessed. He does not pretend to know that in his simple life, something terrible has happened. He does not pretend to know that in his terrible life, something perfect will arrive. He is 36 years old. He has golden hair, a chipped front tooth, calloused hands, a steady soul. His name is Swan. Outside, the sun is washing over the deep green hills in waves, and there he is, adrift in his bed, a man alone in the world. In his sleep, Swan turns his face into the mattress and cries out once, then stops. It's a jagged cry, cut like a piece of metal, the shape of a heart, pulled from deep inside his chest. Beneath the sheet, his body is encircled with scars twisting like purpled vines, twining in tendrils around his legs, his arms, stomach, across the shoulder. His arms reach out, fingers that curl into fists grabbing the air. One dumbly unconscious hand holds something invisible and then lets it go. Swan knows nothing. Swan knows everything. The clock on the bedside table ticks faintly. A wind finds its way under the half-open window. There's a movie in Swan's head. In a field of drowsy yellow flowers, a little girl, no, a baby. A baby girl sits smack upon the warm-tilled ground, stretches up her arms when she sees him bend low, reaches for the folds of his blue shirt, the blue that blots out the sky. Somewhere the dream has already begun, in spite of him, maybe because of him, and around swings the good hard earth and everyone upon it. Downstairs, Grace Blackwater makes coffee, opens curtains, feeds the dog, moves his heart, lets in the light. This is the second section. I, Swan Roby, can't sleep. I've lost the talent. In the middle of the night, I'll go downstairs and find some movie on TV and just sit there in the dark for an hour or so until I don't feel so much like dying. My breath is quick, shallow, and fast, as if I've been running hard, and I have been, outrunning the dreams. I ran track in high school, the 220, the 440. This feels like that, times 50. My hands have a way of shaking out of nowhere, from nothing I can see. The sheets are damp, and there's no air anyplace. These are a couple of side effects, the fallout of being alive. That's what the docs would say, but they'd call them mortality-based manifestations, stemming from some post-fatal event. I read my file, snuck a peek when the nurse left the room. Fatal, but not for me. Here I am, still breathing. Here I am, alive. So I go downstairs just to get out of the bedroom and away from that feeling. Hal, my dog, will join me on the couch. It's a raft, and the night is our ocean. He'll give me his rough paw to hold, and that's how it works. We'll sit side by side, safe within the television's warm blue hum, waiting for something to change, for the hands to settle, the breathing to slow, the waves to subside, watching some slice of a bad movie, the dog and me. Hal will flatten his ears, look at me sideways in animal concern. If you happened to pass our windows at 4 a.m. and just caught the backs of our two heads, you'd probably think we were some old married couple sitting there, insomniac but happy. What we are is a guy who can barely keep his heart in his chest, who is drowning, and an overweight, one-eyed Australian shepherd. And what we are is what is left of three. All around us, the empty rooms of my farmhouse wait in quiet. My grandfather built this place. My father grew up here. I'm the only son of an only son, the last in our line. And these rooms are as familiar to me as my own body. But even this is not a comfort, more a solitary history, knowing every board and beam. Days, I feel the full weight of their silence, and the nights are odd sounds, the wind, a creaking floor, a sharp crack, but all of this is far away. In the middle of the night, I don't have to pretend I can handle anything at all. I can't. If I hear something, I don't move to investigate, don't go from room to room throwing switches. If a rain blows through, as it does here late off the big lake, I let it come. The pale curtains Caroline made billow up like sails, like the skirts of beautiful girls, and the water beads on the screens, puddles at the baseboards. Then the storm passes and the world moves on without me. I don't look too hard for trouble. I know it's there, even in empty rooms. It's hidden in every tiny decision you can make. Turning one way and not another, take the shore road. We're late. We're kept alive by little bits of tape and wire, string, luck, and not so much else. This is a secret I now know. I listen to Hal yawn and shift on the cushions. These nights, the television and the moon are our only light. As for what we watch, Hal and I have our preferences. I'm trying to stop thinking. We're both trying to stay awake. No infomercials or loud music or complicated plots. We settle on movies, okay in black and white, or those pale-tinted 70s films, the brighter 80s and beyond. Even better, anything with shooting, gunfire, really. Anything with fire, anything with bombs, stranglings. Even though before all this, I never watched TV, and now I'm really kind of picky. I have an awful need to see people die, other people, fake death, unreal deaths, made real. How else should I say that? I want to see, this is another secret, to die and not to die, to go on, the perfect Hollywood ending, the blood that's sugar water, corn syrup with red food coloring, still the most realistic, tried and true. I read that once. Hal puts his heavy brown head on my shoulder, leans in and sighs against my neck. The couch is our raft, and our feet have left the floor. We're floating out alone now, far from any shore. Hal's warm fur smells peppery, of cut grass and dirt, a rough blanket thrown from the lawn. Sometimes Caroline and I would lie outside in the yard at night and stare straight up, talking about what we wanted to do with our lives, our hopes, I guess you'd say. I'd hold her hand, lace our fingers, my sweetheart. We didn't have all that long together, not long enough to know much, even if it felt like it then. We didn't know. How could we see? 3 years minus a few days, that was all. Not long enough to fight big more than a few times or grow to dislike each other's ways, to get crazy over old habits, a broken promise, a failure. It was all still possible, all ahead of us, a puzzle. I loved her like that, without reasons. Those nights on the grass outside, our bodies lying side by side, not moving, we'd be just like that, under the dark sky, asking it our questions. So for a while, I did know Caroline. Even in life, she was a little bit of a mystery to me. Maybe all women are to men. You hear that. But we never had time, not really, to see. Would we have been married still in 10 years, had kids, moved away or apart, stayed in love? Where does life go? I don't know. So we'll go on and on the way we were for a minute. And that's how I see us now, two separate bodies holding hands on a scratchy blanket under some black sky, always a little space between, shoulder not quite to shoulder, leg not quite to leg, the bladed grass our bed of nails. I want more than anything to save her. There we are. I spent a few weeks in the hospital after the accident getting put back together, and when I cry, it all shakes loose, something deeper, something I think they forgot to fix. Catch him. He's going under. Get that head stabilized. Jesus, look at this. I won't say it to anyone, but I'm full of broken pieces. Nothing fits together the way it should, even though they said it was amazing, my recovery, the work they did in saving me. Congratulations. I blow my nose on a crumpled napkin I find in the couch cushions or on the sleeve of my T-shirt. It's a sad, sad situation. It's a sad, sad state of mind. The television hums on, sending us its warm blue glow. Go ahead, wrap yourself in twin-ply softness. Comfort is such a strange thing. It's never there, and then it is, and then it's gone again. Am I supposed to cry? I do. And after I cry, my hands go on shaking. What can you tell by looking at someone's hands? I've never really cared about looks, not mine, but the one thing I used to think was that I had good hands, strong, flat-fingered, well-worked, but not anymore. My eyes know what my hands have done. If the shakes don't end by the time Hal and I are into another movie, during a commercial I go into the kitchen and I take a pill, sometimes two. I wash them down with warmish tap water. I don't need to turn on a light. Even in full shadow, I can tell what a mess the room is. I haven't been keeping house these days. There must be a moon somewhere, but just then it's always hidden. I lean on the counter, tap the bottle into my palm, and find my bullets. The pills are dark purple, the size of a very small grape. They have that kind of name, Elysior, a beautiful word, but fake, the first line of a song no one finished writing. And they end my sorrows for an hour or three, and no more. But they make me dream long dreams about people I don't even know and places I've never been. Not long ago, I used to say no to even an aspirin, but now I take what I have. I look without leaping. Bottoms up, I call to Hal through the dark. Here's to good friends. Tonight is kind of special. I go back to the couch, and Hal and I watch some more. And once in a while, some nights we'll get really lucky. And before the pills pull me under the surface, but just after they've made my fingers go still, brought the entire world into perfect focus for the next 4 minutes, someone in one of those great old movies, some B-level classic, will just up and die. Die for the sake of not living anymore. A choice. Hal and I lean in close. And that's what they say about some guy who just dies for no good reason except he's sad. He lost the will to live. He lost the will to live. Now we're getting somewhere. Stupid and senseless, just what we need. He lost it. That guy lost it, I say to Hal, who cocks one ear but doesn't look away from the flickering screen, was blind but now can see. The pills have turned my feelings into glass, and I'm smooth and calm, and all is clear. The middle-aged square jaw actor playing a handsome sad man who is thinking about dying, and he has lost it, the way you lose a wallet or a misplaced set of car keys, a phone number on a scrap of paper, directions home, the want to live, just gone. I flick off the TV before I pass out cold, all is buzzing silence. I sit swirling in that minute of pitch blackness. The dreams already taking hold. I stagger heavy-limbed up the stairs, bouncing off the walls once, twice, then falling back into my bed. I am too gone. I too am gone. It doesn't matter what anyone else says. I carry it inside. Slip this into your pocket when heading out the door. So easy, so portable. I couldn't even see her when she was dying. Once those words would have sounded so crazy, impossible, so far from my own life. We were on a cheap blanket under some stars. One night, this night, I take a couple of extra pills. I'm experimenting. How many? A few. For a moment, I can hold them so close here in my own two steady hands. And I'm going to skip a longer section where Grace, who is in that very first section, comes to wake him up, and they have a conversation about him, sort of getting back to the business of life. And then she leaves. So while Swan is waking up after this night that he was just talking, you'll hear what's going on in the rest of the world. So this is sort of the morning after that scene I just read. And this is another character. Officer Leroy Jessic is deeply bothered by something. It has been a slow dawning realization, a creeping sense of wrong, each small detail floating free, then finally and all at once, every clue locking into place in perfect understanding, the truth, however grotesque, revealing itself at last. It is the way of all good detective work. This is not a carrot cake sunrise muffin, he whispers out loud and to no one. This is a double bran. True, the two muffins look something alike from the outside at first glance. If you weren't really looking too closely, if you didn't really care about your customer and just reached in and grabbed any old muffin from the case, then you might not be able to tell, no. But after one bite, it's painfully and immediately obvious. This muffin is not the muffin he ordered. Damn it all to hell, he shouts, and then baseballs the thing fast pitch style, out over the side of the bluff. Doesn't anyone listen? Doesn't anyone look? A few seconds later, he can hear the bran muffin hit the water below with a satisfying gulp. Sure, he had been flirting with the counter girl, Mandy Latoka, and maybe she got distracted. Who wouldn't? But she seemed to be enjoying the attention, or at least she should have. For one thing, Officer Leroy Jessic is fairly hot, and for another thing, he knows it. He was even featured as Mr. February on the Tri-County Men of Law Enforcement calendar, 1998. Was that 5 years ago? Time flies. When the photographer, some weird guy from Traverse, had told him to get comfortable and offered him a glass of wine, Officer Jessic had ended up posed without a shirt, kneeling on a deerskin rug, handgun drawn. The calendar raised $8,000 for charities, sick kids or something. February was the most popular month. That's what he'd heard. People left February up long after the month had come and gone, just to see Officer Jessic bare-chested. It got so that he had to change his phone number. So many women, girls, were calling him at all hours. A flood of women for a time. Then he had to go and get engaged. Everyone makes mistakes. That's what Officer Jessic told himself. You couldn't be perfect 24/7. Still, without all the women, it is a burden, being the coolest dude on their small force. But Officer Jessic tries to keep it real, tries to keep it all about crime, not what kind of moose he uses, not how much he can bench. He runs his fingers through his spiky hair. Gotcha, he says. He makes a gun with his free hand, points it out over the big light. Pow, pow, pow. He's never actually fired a bullet in the line of duty, but he has hope. His day will come. Right then, Officer Jessic wishes he had another bran muffin to throw. He feels like hitting something. He spits and coughs, getting rid of all trace of bran flecks. He will go back to Green's Bakery, get his $1.29 from that Latoka girl, you can be sure. But right now, he is 5 miles up the shore at an investigation site, and there is nothing else to eat. He sips at his coffee. At least there's it. This, Blue Mountain with just a hint of cinnamon. His fiancée brewed it for him and put it in his favorite travel thermos mug just before he left for work. She's thoughtful like that, a sweet girl. He needs to remember this, her good qualities, when he doubts their upcoming wedding, as he does now and then. Well, most of the time he is awake. When he is not awake, Officer Leroy Jessic is asleep but dreaming. And when he is dreaming, it is about a car accident. He doesn't tell anyone this, about the dreams, not even his fiancée, about the twisting metal and the glass. The whole idea has him scared. No, more or less freaked out. Officer Leroy Jessic is never really scared. It is this very accident, the one that took place 6 months before to the day, right here where he is standing. A car, driven by an old high school buddy, Swan Roby, slid on the turn at Officer Jessic's back, icy then, in January, and sailed right off the bank above the water, landing smack down on a ledge above the frozen lake below, somewhere short of where the bran muffin just hit. Officer Leroy Jessic thinks of the accident sometimes during the day. Sure, it was the third vehicular death he had ever seen, and yes, he knew both passenger and driver, and yeah, it was a bad scene, really ugly, and things like this never really happened in his town. So it made them seem worse, much, much worse. But mostly now, instead of filling his days, his conversation, the accident haunts his sleep. He's never dreamed before, not in his life, not that he can remember anyway. Maybe just some regular normal dreams about naked girls now and then. But here they were, these strange dreams of the accident in full color slow motion, whole movies. The acceleration, the long nosedive down to the lake, thick and hard as marble, the way the vehicle flipped and hit instead upside down on a narrow ledge, only as wide as the car itself, a few yards above the frozen water. How it had hung there, raining glass until help arrived too late, the wife dead, and Swan having crashed through the windshield long before, and how he looked flat out on the lake, arms thrown open wide across the snow, a man asleep in white sheets, asleep on water. Officer Jessic had dreams of the accident twice in the previous week, then again only the night before. In the latest dream, he arrives at the crash site just in time to block the car, to keep it from sailing off the embankment. He stands on the edge of the bluff, spread leg and crouched, like a bear, a sumo wrestler bear. He is not wearing a shirt, and he reaches out to stop the hurtling car, to push it back with his two strong hands. It is summer and no one dies. Swan and his wife wave through the windshield, smile at Officer Jessic, back up and drive on. That was a close one. In real life, Officer Leroy Jessic looks down and grabs the roll of flab hanging over his belt buckle, around his middle, the physical evidence of all his fiancée's casseroles, of all the ice cream and the donuts. He has a gut. Mr. February Law Enforcement is packing 10 extra pounds. He sucks it up and is suddenly secretly glad Mandy Latoka messed up his muffin order. Carrot cake sunrise muffins are out. He needs to get back in fighting shape if he's going to crack this case. He's going to need to look like he did in 98, buff and crime ready, calendar material. Engagement has not agreed with him. He is a lone wolf, a single alpha male, now suddenly tied to a tree in someone's backyard, force-fed chicken pot pies. No wonder he's gone slack. But all of this is about to change. Officer Leroy Jessic begins to pace the road above the bluff, sipping his coffee. It is a beautiful day, clear skies, no wind, not yet 8 a.m. He pulls out a tiny tape recorder from his front pocket. He bought it at Radio Shack on sale. 7:59 a.m. Buy protein powder, he whispers. Buy lettuce, carb burner tablets. He sighs and bites his lip, thinks for a second. The receiver band crackles from inside his cruiser. Can you swing by and get a miner off the pancake house roof? Over. And then goes silent. He slips the tape recorder back in his pocket. One thing that has begun to bother Officer Leroy Jessic is the way Swan's car seemed to skid so freely on the ice before it flew out over the bank. Where were the brakes marks, the sharp turn of the wheel? Where were the attempts to stop? Textbook-type evidence, for sure, but no one else seemed to notice. Officer Jessic has gotten back on his stomach, right on the ice and seen nothing. In one of his dreams. At the time, of course, he'd done nothing. It was just a terrible accident, open and shut. That was the problem. He was remembering this, seeing this all in some kind of crazy dream. But the way he did see it every night, there was no stopping. There had been none. The car was like a rocket, straight and sure, right off the side. True, there wasn't a guardrail, nothing to break the fall. If a car did start to head over the bluff, save for a few small pines, banks of powdery snow, but the car just flew as if no one had tried to stop it. Of course, there's no way to prove this, not yet anyway. Accident, on purpose. This is what bothers him, most of all. He's not some weirdo into angels and fairies and all of that, but these dreams are like a movie, clear as life. He is keeping his mouth shut. No one needs to know about any of this. The case is all his. The sun is full in his eyes, and he reaches for his shades. Just then, something glints on the road. He pulls out his mini tape recorder. 8 a.m., he whispers. Evidence piece number one. Officer Leroy Jessic bends to pick it up, a silver shard on the sun-warm blacktop. Just then, his back seizes. It feels like he's in the grip of a grizzly, its claws deep in his spine. Jesus! His face twists, mouth open. He drops his thermal coffee mug, and it hits once, splashes on the toes of his regulation shiny black shoes. He drops the shard. He falls to his knees. God damn, that settles it, he says, crouched on the edge of the blacktop, knees in the exact spot Swan's car left the earth. I'm on a diet, like yesterday. I'm just going to read two more short sections. Just other characters and what they're doing at exactly the same moment. Grace Blackwater rides her motorcycle down the hill fast. She tucks her body into the wind, crouched and coiled, hurdles hard as a thrown fist. At rest, she is clumsy, big-limbed, awkwardly strong. In motion, she makes sense. Only then is Grace full of grace, quick and sleek as a silver lure, a bullet meeting its mark. She doesn't wear a helmet, and her hair streams out behind, a shining black tangle. The sunlight is stamped across her face in lines cut by trees that knife the light. The trees are white pine, planted in row after row of perfect symmetry by Swan Roby's grandfather, now long dead. His trees live on. Grace flickers past them, shadow and clear, the only moving figure caught in the frames of a stuttering film. Back in the open fields, the warmth of the sun is full upon her bare head, pressing her forward when she takes the curves. She knows it will rain later. This is the way the air smells, like burnt match ends and lightning cut early rye. The grasshoppers hold a certain note as she passes, signaling the storm, but she doesn't hear them. It is cloudless, 67 degrees, and no one else in the world might guess what Grace has begun. Every atom spins faster in each tiny thing she passes, the living, the never living, in the stones, in the road itself. Swan Roby is in a house on the hill far behind her, in his bed, but not asleep, his thoughts moving out across the surface of water. He throws off his sheet and walks to the shower. How does it feel? How does it feel? Grace sings out as the morning whips by, her voice scratchy and loud. Grace is sad, it's true, but the road is long and she wants it to be, and gravel kicks up as she revs faster, sending pebbles spinning off into secret patterns, held into space for less than a quarter of an eye's blink, and then gone. Again on the blacktop, she slices straight down the yellow line, turns on Pleasant View, rides past her turn, dodges a pothole, doubles back. Her life. She has a motorcycle, some friends, a mother, a little hard luck, good work, and no one else. Her song is swallowed whole by the trees. Only a few silent words break free and travel out across the big lake in the distance and go on and on. Grace takes the long way around, riding until the feeling of sadness has lifted from her shoulders. Is this love the wreck in the center of her chest? Swan will get better, and Swan will be okay. Grace will never let him know about the sad mixed in with the deep affection, about her longing and her clumsy arms, unfit to hold such beauty. For now, there is only a certain pull of light, the small word she can give him, a life return for the one he has lost. Grace comes to a stop at the shop, a converted barn set back from the road, several garages and outbuildings for the trucks and tools, exactly 8 minutes later. The office is in addition to the barn, newer wood. The trucks are lined up in their stalls ready for the day, and the men are outside, all 11 shining employees of Roby Landscaping, minus one. Fidel Carteza is not yet there. The first time in 5 years he has ever been late. Seven men nurse hangovers on this Monday morning. They wait in a loose circle, sipping coffee from styrofoam cups, fighting early day fatigue, lack of sleep, family troubles, girlfriend troubles, money troubles. The men wipe at their eyes as if to brush away headaches just beginning, not yet begun. Think of all of this, about their boss and what Grace will say. She had been the one to go and get Swan. Finally, only she could. What Grace will say about their boss, whose car had flipped twice, fell, and smacked with a flight and force of a meteor, a sad chunk of hurtling star, upside down upon a lake above Lake Michigan, exactly 6 months before to the day. What Grace will say. The men know the story in detail, the way the windshield had exploded out and across the ice when Swan was thrown through, glass shards raining down from a dark sky for half an hour, maybe more. Officer Tom Jessic, first on the scene, is the brother of Big Mike, one of the guys, and later he told all about the raining glass and about Swan and about Caroline, his wife, and about the helicopter who came for them both, one breathing, one not. They never said too much to Swan those first days he was out of the hospital. Weeks, then months, when he'd stop by to see the guys, but not to work, not yet, walking like a dead man upright, what could they say, except, hey boss, I'm sorry, God man, I'm so sorry, sorry, let me know if, hey, I'm sorry. It might have been any of them. Didn't they know this? But it wasn't. It was Swan, and his life scared them. He made them a little bit afraid. His shirt hid scars, but they were there. And now they stare at Grace Blackwater, their foreman. They know never to call her foreperson, or even worse, forewoman. She's told them she doesn't have time for foolishness, and those words are for fools. Grace has known most of the men since they were boys. Grace can beat them up, any or all of them, any time, and they are aware. Grace straddles her motorbike, a vision before them. She rakes at a huge knot in her hair with stiff fingers, spits once delicately. She yanks a tube of cherry chapstick from her front jeans pocket and smears it across her lips in one messy swipe. She recaps the tube and jerks her chin at the men, who watch her, their own mouths slack. But she's not about to tell them a single fact about Swan, not yet. Hey, you, Grace barks at no one in particular. Do paychecks grow on trees at your house, smartass, hey? She spits again, coughs. Did you hang up the banner in the office? Did you pick up the cake? Am I talking to a bunch of stumps here? Lyle, Pete Botile, Little Doug, Big Mike, Frank Kay, Smiley, Bernard, and the two Jose's stare at their boots. Takes quick sips of coffee. Grace narrows her eyes, especially at her cousin Bernard. Does he look stoned? Sits higher on the motorcycle's lushly padded seat. Yeah, you, and you, and you, and you. The men glance up and then back at the ground. Grace flips the bird at Pete Botile just for good measure, points her chapstick tube in the general direction of his chest. He gives her a wink, crosses his arms. He is definitely stoned. Beyond this, his laziness is legendary. Grace does a quick head count. Is Marjorie in the office yet? And where the hell is Fidel, she asks. The men shake their heads, shrug. Grace sighs. Her work in life is never done. Her sad heart filling inside her great leather jacket, straining against the silver zippers and buckles. She tries again, her voice broken and rocky. We got to get ready here. Surprise party, remember? Is anyone listening? Hey? The men still don't move. They are confused. Surprise party? Their heads ache with Grace's gravelly commands. Man, says one of the Jose's, leaning against the barn and trying to smoke. What's up with Nurse Ratchet? Grace hears him, climbs off her motorcycle, kicks at the ground. Jesus H. Christ, am I the only person who cares around here? And try to be normal, if that's even possible. Get yourselves hid. He'll be here in a few minutes. Grace means swan, whose life she has just inadvertently saved. And I'm going to read one more very short section with Grace's mother. This is what she's doing at the same time. Ramona Blackwater stands in her backyard feeding cheese puffs to the birds. For every one she hands off to a blue jay or a starling, she stuffs another in her mouth. She has a way with animals, Ramona does, cheese puffs or not, they come to her. The trick is to talk to an animal the way you would any other person, not the way most people do when they turn to a dog or a cat or even a fish in a bowl, gumming the words in that squeaky voice baby talk as if to a very small child or an aged adult gone soft in the brain. The trick is no trick at all. Just talk. Lay it on the line. So Ramona is talking as she stalks across the grass that needs mowing, lumpy tufts and hummocks of weedy patches every few steps. She crunches cheese puffs as she walks, laying out the whole story for the birds. She is wearing her sateen bowling jacket, new hip hugger jeans she bought at Girl Time in the mall in Little Traverse. They do hug her hips, these jeans. They squeeze like an anaconda shoved through love-slung belt loops, and she swings side to side with each step, totters on white glitter heels that sink into the deep grass like tent stakes. Grace, her daughter, has been at Ramona to dress her age lately. Lately, a loud panic rising in her voice when she sees Ramona's pleather jeans and tube tops, as if it's an emergency, a fire in the kitchen, Ramona's clothing. But Ramona doesn't listen, never has listened to anyone, and never will. What's she supposed to wear? Aprons and elastic waist pants, Velcro safety sneakers and a shawl, white cardigan sweaters with Kleenex stuffed up into the sleeves? Ramona has the figure of a schoolgirl, and she's not about to hide her light under a bushel barrel. Grace, on the other hand, dresses like a man, Ramona thinks. Motorcycle jacket and heavy boots. Who is she to talk? Grace would be 66 one day, and then she'd see. Ramona personally couldn't wait. She planned to live a very long time just to witness Grace as a senior citizen, to see how much she liked dressing as a grandmother, which Ramona decidedly is not yet anyway. She's going to shake it until they put her in the ground. What was the point otherwise? Life had to be grabbed good and hard by the throat, and if you ended up choking it, well, so it went. The night before, Ramona had been down at the Pine Top Lounge, dancing slow with Simon Joe, a plumber 5 years her junior, who kept sneaking his hand down to rest on her hip-huggered rump. Ramona had gotten a ride home with him at 1 a.m., her elaborately curled black hair lopsided and full of smoke, and she had fallen asleep in her clothes, heels and all, her feet on the pillow, elevated for good circulation. Grace was up and gone before Ramona had even opened her eyes, but Ramona had heard her, half in sleep, and known right where Grace was headed, straight for trouble. That girl. But now it is a beautiful morning, not a cloud anywhere in the blue above, and Ramona has her house, the whole yard, to herself. She surveys the green hills in the distance, pokes one of her glittery toes into the rows of carrots and beans just beginning to sprout in her vegetable garden. Behind her is her little house, the roof tilted slightly south, a TV antenna indicating north. Her nephew Bernard's Chevy van is dead in the driveway, in need of a jump. Ramona snorts and stuffs another cheese puff into her mouth and wanders over to a patch of raspberry brambles. So anyway, she says to a small crow who has fluttered down to clamp around her index finger with sharp claws. Then Gracie, that's my daughter, right? Hey, Gracie, my daughter who moved in here to take care of me. Ha! Like I need a caretaker. More like the other way around, you know what I mean? So Gracie gets it in her head she's going to be the one to help this guy, save him, you know. He had a real bad car accident, lost his wife. It's a sad story. Ramona crunches thoughtfully, shakes her head. The cheese puffs are off limits, technically. Bad for her high blood pressure, too much salt, something like that. Also bad for her diabetes, or so they say. Ramona has taken to hiding the bag from Grace, this week in the bathroom cupboard behind the extra rolls of toilet paper, where Grace probably won't think to look. She has to keep moving her stash, though. Grace is always searching for something, always on the prowl. Ramona pulls another handful of cheese puffs from her jacket pocket, and her fingers swirl bright orange powder on the lawn, the dust settling in strange patterns on the grass. I surely could use a beverage, Ramona confides. She'd drink a pink gin fizz right now if it wasn't before 8 a.m., a blueberry rum colada. Instead, she sighs, bites in a puff in half, places places the other in the crow's open beak. The bird accepts it but doesn't move. See, what's wrong with my daughter, Ramona goes on, is that she's got this problem I read about in the Martha Stewart magazine. Maybe it was Reader's Digest or Ladies' Home Journal, one of them. I took the quiz for her at the end. She had a real high score, you know, off their scale. Ramona chews and nods and takes the bird from her finger and places it on her shoulder. The crow stretches one wing, ducks slightly, goes back to listening, its head tucked low. My daughter Gracie has got that female survivor savior syndrome pretty bad. It's because of some issues she had with her daddy. That was my first husband, Vincent. Abandonment, etc. And some other issues with life in general. I'd call them issues. We have to get her cured, hey? I tell you what. Ramona crunches the last of her cheese puffs, savoring every sodium and chemical lace swallow, smacks her lips, rubs her hands on her low-slung jeans. She's in the middle of the yard now, facing the road and the trees beyond it. Grace thinks she's going to save this guy, Swan. That's his name, the guy I'm talking about here. But it's love. I know it's love because she's in love. And you know that's going to get in the way. It'll cloud up whatever she thinks she's seeing. Ramona nods at the obvious outcome. This guy's got other things, big things, trust me, to deal with right now. But does Grace see this? No, she doesn't. Me? Well, a mother hates to see her baby in pain, hey? The crow fastens Ramona with one shiny eye, a sequin sewn with a single loop of thread. The bird is still holding the broken cheese puff in its beak. Do you like Martha Stewart? Ramona asks, watching the way the leaves shift, kaleidoscope in a slight breeze. She narrows her gaze at something invisible far in the distance. Personally, and I don't use this phrase too often now, but personally, I think she's probably a real bitch on wheels. A car, a large blue van, tops the road at the crest of the hill, growing larger and larger as it crosses the small valley, comes to a slow roll by Ramona's yard. It makes the turn into her driveway in a cloud of dust. Oh, hell. Ah, hell, Ramona mutters. The crow flies off with the cheese puff to a high branch, and Ramona tries to stuff her hands in her pockets of her pinching jeans. She squints at the driver, a young blonde woman with a clipboard who is getting out too fast to be stopped. On the side of the station wagon in block letters, Ramona reads, Bay Shore County Council on Aging Outreach. Damn it, Grace, Ramona whispers. All I did was go to the bar. She totters on her glittery heels. No escape from the small yard. All the birds are listening, safe in their trees. Swan Roby is opening his front door, discovering something remarkable. Grace is back on her motorcycle, singing in the wind, and Ramona can see all of it if she wants to. When she wants to, she sees. She shuts her eyes. She is hungover. She is sighted beyond this yard. Her heels are sinking into the dark earth, pinning her fast. Mrs. Blackwater! Hello, Mrs. Blackwater! The woman calls to Ramona in a voice she recognizes as one saved for cows led to slaughter, for the kitten before it is put in a cloth sack and tossed in a lake. Something soothing and full of malice. Mrs. Blackwater, how are we doing this morning? That's the end of that. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone has a question.
Swan is an unusual name for a character. I was just wondering what inspired you to name
Swan. It sounds not very interesting, but it just sort of came to me. I guess I wanted almost a somewhat feminine name or sort of a beautiful name for who is sort of a masculine character and sort of a tortured character. So I wanted something sort of lovely to contrast who he is, I think. Yeah.
The characters you were writing on, are they composites of lots of people you've met or you've read about or heard about, or how did you begin to develop those characters?
In my first book, and as when I was talking to Stephanie earlier, I think all my characters are composites, and I often think of them as people I'd like to know. And I think about them when I'm writing, I think about my characters all the time, and I think about what they're doing, and I sort of see them as having parallel lives almost. So I take my characters physically, it's harder for me to picture them, but I hear their voices very clearly. I hear the sound of what they would sound like if they were talking. So sometimes I'll overhear a comment or someone will say something. It's usually, character usually comes from a line almost. And it's more a voice than the physical presence. So I can hear what they would say, and I think I have a good idea of how they sound. But they are very much composites and not really based on anyone in particular, you know? Just, I think, people that I would enjoy spending time with, because when you're writing a novel, you spend, you know, years with these people, so...
They also seem pretty indigenous to here.
Yeah, they are.
They sounded familiar.
Yeah, they're very much of a particular place. And I really like very much regional writing, you know, characters who are very rooted in a particular place, who seem like they're sort of part of a particular landscape. So.
Both of your books are set in northern Michigan?
Yeah.
And that, obviously, that's very conscious. I mean, you wanted to place them there because you're familiar with that? Or?
Yeah, not even so much conscious. I think it's just where these things seem to take place in my head. You know, that just seems to be the backdrop, and so much of the writing is tied to a particular place. So for me, my fictional world is very much in that particular location, that particular landscape.
You wrote, reading that section about Swan and the band, Odal, he was going through, obviously, severe depression. You wrote that eloquently, so.
Thank you.
But really, what someone begins to when they have a panic attack. Medication you referred to, however, wasn't Xanax, and that's what I was expecting.
Oh, really? I just made something up. Yeah, so that's interesting.
You're very close, and it's going to be very poignant when your readers read this, because so much of America, this is it's a gripping disease. My question is, have you or one of your family members, or did you do research on depression to, you hit it pretty close, but you're a little off
mark. With the pill. Yeah, actually I did. I went to the library and got a couple books, and I have a couple books. So I do, you know, research into something like that. I actually enjoy research. But yeah, it's, you know, in my first book I had a character whose depression is never really quite identified specifically, so I guess I'm always a little bit leery of labeling something specifically. Yeah, well, that's good to know. I mean, that's, you know, it's a good point, yeah.
That's the magical part of being a writer. It's nothing, it's difficult to describe, but it's almost as if you go into a trance.
Mm-hmm.
You have this resourcefulness, and you can't conjure up, you can't bring up things that perhaps you yourself haven't experienced, but you're kind of a sponge for all these different things you've seen, and they're somewhere back there in your head. But then they will come up as you write. You will recall them without having had that experience yourself. And you're not the character, but you are bringing back that world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go back there and you live with funny sort of thing, but once you live with characters long enough, then you can get that sense of
humor. Yeah, kind of empathy for what they are going through, hopefully.
Right.
That's credible. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's always good to hear specifics, you know.
Did you find that happened to you when that happened to you?
Yeah, very much. I mean, I really feel for this person, and I try and imagine what it would be like. And so, you know, you sort of, you try to put yourself in that person's place. How would you feel if you'd been through this, and what would it feel like if you were sitting there? And yeah. Writers, you know, I think, try to be as empathetic as possible, but the finer points, I mean, it's always interesting to hear, you know, those minute differences that are actually really important. Questions? Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you.